Wednesday, February 26th. Happy Wednesday, February 26th, 2020. It is time to read the Fort Dodge Messenger. We are reading to you from our studio located at Friendship Haven in Fort Dodge. I am Shirley Webb. My partner at the mic today is Sarah Kelly. We are glad to have you listening. We will start with a look at today's weather and the headlines from our front page. The weather today is supposed to be a high of 23 and a low of 13. You may expect skies will be cloudy. There will be a north-northwest wind of 11 to 16 miles per hour. Today's headline, a large colored picture of room to grow, apartment zoning clears first hurdle. Deconstruction, breaker space gives Cooper kids room to be creative. Humboldt Twin Rivers is moving forward with their search for a superintendent. DCI, no charges in death of Webster City woman and her child. And the final front page article, Iowa Central seeks bigger space for inmate training. Now here to read our first story is Sarah.
Room to grow. Apartment zoning clears first hurdle. The Fort Dodge Plan and Zoning Commission voted Tuesday afternoon to recommend a zoning change for 10.3-acre parcel of land near the Fort Dodge Middle School from agricultural to residential multifamily to make some new apartments possible. The change, if approved by the City Council, would let Eagle Construction of Sioux Falls, South Dakota, build a 93-unit apartment complex near the intersection of North 29th Street and 6th Avenue North. Josh Kruger, Vice President of Eagle Construction, attended the meeting to answer questions. "We would like to get moving as soon as possible," Kruger said, "and we would like to start construction in early summer." He said it would take about 13 months to finish the build. The complex would be a mix of studio, one- and two-bedroom apartments, while actual rent would vary with the size and layout. He said units would range from about $700 a month to about $1,065 a month. Size would range from 570 square feet for the studio units up to 960 square feet for the two-bedroom units. There would be no three-bedroom units. You get too close to townhouses rent, Kruger said. Most people who are looking for a three-bedroom prefer a condo. Kruger said his company currently has about 1,500 individual apartments. They have buildings in Mason City, Sioux City, Spirit Lake, Sheldon, and several others. "We have a really good track record with communities in Iowa. We also still hold all the units we build." The project would also include two 12-unit garage buildings and five-unit townhouse complexes. Kruger said that the future plans call for additional phase two construction. The recommendation for the change passed unanimously. It will now be considered by the full City Council at its March 9th meeting. In other action, the Plan and Zoning Commission also voted new officers for 2020. The new chair is Steve Kirsten, last year's vice chair. Mike Dole is this year's vice chair. The board rotates members through the leadership positions. Last year's chair was board member Lisa Wilson. Included in this article is a colored picture of Josh Kruger, who is vice president of Eagle Construction Incorporation of Sioux Falls, and he is speaking in front of the city of the Fort Dodge Plan and Zoning Commission about a zoning change from agricultural to residential multifamily that would allow his company to build the 93-unit apartment complex on 10.3 acres of plot near the middle school. The commission approved the zoning change, and it now moves into consideration by the full city council. And also on this in the paper is a zoning map, and it shows where the proposed apartment buildings would be construction. And on the front page, is a black and white picture, and this is where it shows where, while it's corn stubble and dirt, now a 10.3-acre plot of land at North 29th Street and 6th Avenue North. It shows where it was recommended by the Fort Dodge Planning Commission to be rezoned from agriculture to multifamily residential Tuesday afternoon. And now, of course, the recommendation is now goes to the full city council.
Deconstruction, and there's a colored picture here on this article of Ty Nguyen, who is a Cooper fourth grader. He's showing librarian Jean Black part of the old VCR. He and a classmate have deconstructed during a Breaker Space activity on Tuesday morning. Breaker Space gives Cooper kids room to be creative. In the library at Cooper Elementary School, a pair of students worked to dismantle a piece of ancient technology once used by their ancestors, a VCR with a VHS of the movie Shrek stuck in it. On the next table, another pair of students are taking apart a remote-controlled toy tank, methodically removing each screw, keeping the cover attached to the tank's body. How do you unscrew a screw? Cooper librarian Jean Black asked fourth grader Zach Palm as he worked on the tank. Lefty is loosey, righty is tighty, he responded as he demonstrated on the toy. The students were participating in Breaker Space time in the school's library, while other students work in a maker space, creating things. These students work to deconstruct old toys and small appliances. Black had heard of other schools doing similar activities and already had a student who enjoyed dismantling old TV remote controls. His name is Gavin Sankey. He is in the third grade, she said. He just wanted to take everything apart that I had that I didn't use anymore. I started looking up ideas of what to do with parts you take apart, and it just gives kids a chance to be creative. There are no rules, really, except for the safety rules that we have. Students are given tools like screwdrivers and pliers and are shown how to safely use them. They also have personal protective equipment like glasses and gloves when necessary. I tell them they can't force it apart. They have to figure out how it comes apart, Black explained. The idea is for them to look at it and see how it works. When the power source is on, and how that fits into the circuit board and things like that. As students take the items apart, they put some of the pieces in a box which will be used to make new things. It's repurposing, Black said. When we get all the parts, we start making weird stuff with the parts. They can just be creative and do whatever they want, and they will learn how to use hot glue guns and maybe soldering equipment for the older kids. While Palm and classmate Josh Townsend worked to open the toy tank, Palm said he didn't know what to expect once they got it open. I don't really see any moving pieces beside the tires, he said. At the next table, fourth graders Ty Nguyen and Bennett Nkvenda were focused on freeing the Shrek videotape from the VCR. The age of technology didn't faze Nguyen. My mom has one of these things at home, he said. Eventually, the boys were able to break the videotape free from its vise. There was a little piece of plastic holding it down on the side, Nkvenda explained. Then they moved on to deconstructing the circuit boards and other parts of the machine. It's like the pieces of the middle of a fidget spinner, Nguyen described one of the pieces he removed. Nkvenda said he enjoyed breaking stuff during his time in the library. It is fun to take stuff apart, he said. Black said the school welcomes old toys and small machines for students to deconstruct, but we don't just want everybody's garbage at the front door. Those interested in donating items to the Breaker Space can call the school office, and the school office number 515-574-5602. And there are two colored pictures of these students dismantling this equipment. The first one is Cooper fourth grader Zach Palm working to dismantle an old remote-controlled tank, while his classmate Josh Townsend supervises supervises, and in the final picture, Cooper fourth graders Bennett Nkvenda and Tai Wen were together taking apart an old broken VCR machine during a Brakerspace activity in the library this last Tuesday morning.
Okay. Humboldt Twin Rivers move forward with search for superintendent. Humboldt aims to hire new head by March 20th. The Humboldt Community School District Board of Directors and the Twin Rivers Community School District Board of Directors are moving forward with the search for a permanent replacement for longtime superintendent Greg Darling. Darling, who had been the superintendent for the two districts since 2008, was placed on paid administration by HCSD Board on January 20th through June 30th. June 30th is the date when Darling's early retirement will become effective. The board has declined to explain why Darling was placed on leave. Darling remains the Twin Rivers superintendent at 20% of the time for the two districts' sharing agreement. During a joint work session on Tuesday evening, the two boards met with Prairie Areas Lake Area's Educational Agency Chief Administrator Jeff Hirschberg, who is assisting Humboldt with the superintendent's search. There will be a community focus group from 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. on March 3rd at the Humboldt High School Media Center. For community members who are unable to attend, there is an online electronic survey they can fill out at tinyurl.com/Humboldt Superintendent 2020. There will be more focus groups throughout the day on March 4th, including with staff at the middle school and high school, department heads, central office staff, bus drivers, high school students, and more. Hirschberg will be asking questions like, what are you looking for in the next superintendent? What are the strengths of the district? And what are the challenges for the district? During a March 9th school board meeting, Hirschberg will be presenting the top 10 superintendent candidates in a closed session. With the two districts sharing agreement, the superintendent's contract is with Humboldt. That means the Humboldt School Board has the sole authority of hiring the superintendent. During Tuesday's night joint work session, Twin Rivers School Board member Christine Olson voiced her concern that Twin Rivers have input in the decision-making. Tate Santern, president of the Humboldt School Board, said Twin Rivers can be involved in the process. On March 17th and 18th, there will be interviews of the four finalists, two on each day. Each candidate interviewed with high school students, central office staff, returning administrators, staff members, community members, and board members in several sessions throughout the day. At the end of the 2 days of interviews, the board will deliberate and decide on a candidate to offer the superintendent's job. The Humboldt School Board aims to have a contract signed with the next superintendent on March 20th. Hirschberg said the reason for the expedited process is so that Humboldt would be able to have its pick of the best candidates before other school districts begin their hiring process. That crop of candidates is limited, so the earlier the better in terms of hiring, he said. I'm really trying to find the best fit for this position. Santern shared his support of Hirschberg's effort in the superintendent's search. I have absolute confidence in Jeff's work, Santern said. He provided us with an amazing pool of individuals for an intern. I have full confidence that Mr. Hirschberg will provide us with a wonderful, wonderful candidate.
DCI, no charges in death of Webster City woman and her child. The article is from Webster City. No charges will be filed with the investigation that has concluded into the death of a Webster City woman and her infant daughter, according to the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation. Marion Giles Figueroa Ortez, age 28, and her three-month-old daughter, Abemeli Ortez Figueroa, were found deceased on November 10th, 2019 at 721 Des Moines Street. Autopsies were performed on both individuals by the Iowa State Medical Examiner's Office. Autopsy results indicated that Mary Ann Giles Figueroa Ortiz's cause of death was ligature hanging. And the manner of her death was suicide. Her daughter's cause of death was unknown, and the manner of her death was undetermined. At approximately 8:13 a.m. on November 10th, Webster City police officers responded to the residence following the report of a roommate who had discovered two bodies. Both of the deceased were residents of 721 Des Moines Street. Webster City Police Department requested the assistance of the Iowa DCI to conduct a death investigation. The DCI, along with the Webster City Police Department, the Hamilton County Sheriff's Office, and the Iowa State Medical Examiner's Office, have concluded this investigation in this manner.
Iowa Central seeks bigger space for inmate training. College dean makes case to lawmakers. Since Iowa Central Community College began offering a form of financial aid to prison inmates called Second Chance Pell about 4 years ago, 470 of them have taken classes. The college has issued more than 9,000 credits to inmates of the Fort Dodge Correctional Facility and the North Central Correctional Facility in Lockwell City. College degrees have been awarded to 50 inmates. College officials believe a lot more inmates could be earning credits and degrees if a bigger and better training build was available at Fort Dodge Correctional Facility. So, on Tuesday, Neil Adams, the College Dean of Business and Industrial Technology, went to Des Moines to talk to lawmakers about that possibility. If we had a bigger building and a building that is better configured to the educational purpose, we would have the capacity to train a lot more inmates, Adams said Tuesday evening. The ultimate goal, he said, is to create positive citizens once they're released. On Tuesday, he spoke to the House Senate Infrastructure Appropriations Committee about the need for a better facility. Our goal is to put it on their radar right now, Adams said. Iowa Central leaders want lawmakers to designate some money from the Rebuild Iowa Infrastructure Fund to pay for the building, according to Jim Kirsten, the college's vice president of external affairs and government relations. The Rebuild Iowa Infrastructure Fund is the state government share of gambling revenue that is set aside for building projects. During his presentation, Adams explained the Second Chance Pell program, which began in August 2016. We're the only post-secondary institution in the state of Iowa that can offer Pell grants to people who are incarcerated. Inmates can use those grants to pay for classes in welding, supply chain management, carpentry, baking and pastry arts, and industrial machinery. The space now available for those classes at Fort Dodge Correctional Facility is very small, according to Adams. In his presentation to the lawmakers, he reported that welding programs usually has 40 students per semester, but there are just 5 welding booths in which they can work. The committee took no action on the proposal Tuesday. Kirsten said further action would probably come in the form of an amendment to a spending bill.
We'll move on now. I believe that concludes page 1 to page 2 from our files. On February of 2005, Ellen Wurspan, a retired Otteson farmer, and Ron Meyer, a retired West Bend farmer, make the first stop on their tour at the grand opening of the Voyager ethanol plant in Emmitsburg. Pat Baumgartner, materials handling engineer pictured at the left, explains the grain receiving idea, including that the concrete bin will hold 3,500 tons of the Dakota Gold product. The Messenger poll this week's question: do you support raising the state sales tax by a penny to help pay for water quality and mental health programs? And that report will be updated weekly, and the answers will be published on Sunday. I'll read this date in history. It's pretty short today. This is Wednesday, February 26th, the 57th day of 2020. There are 309 days left in this year. On February 26, 1993, a truck bomb built by Islamic extremists exploded in the parking garage of the North Tower of New York's World Trade Center, killing six people and injuring more than 1,000 others. The bomb failed to topple the North Tower into the South Tower, as the terrorists had hoped. Both structures were destroyed in the 9/11 attack 8 years later. On this date in 1916, actor-comedian Jackie Gleason was born in Brooklyn, New York. In 1917, President Woodrow Wilson signed a congressional act establishing Mount McKinley National Park, now Denali National Park, in the Alaska Territory. In 1919, President Woodrow Wilson signed a congressional act establishing the Grand Canyon National Park in Arizona. In 1929, President Calvin Coolidge signed a measure establishing Grand Teton National Park in Wyoming. In the thought for today, if you have it and you know you have it, then you have it. If you have it and don't know you have it, you don't have it. If you don't have it but think you have it, then you have it. And that quote is from Jackie Gleason and his lifespan 1916 through 1987.
I think we'll go on to page 3. I don't see anything.
That's it.
Okay. Otherwise, if I miss something, we'll go back. A Fort Dodge man arrested for Prestige semi-trailer theft. A Fort Dodge man was arrested Monday night after being taken to the ground by Fort Dodge police officers for allegedly stealing a Prestige Foods semi-trailer. Dion Clayton, 27, was charged with first-degree theft, a Class C felony, interference with official acts causing bodily injury, a serious misdemeanor, and felony possession of a firearm, a Class D felony. Officers were notified that the 2020 Mack Anthem, valued at over $120,000, was on the street driving Monday while it was supposed to be in the shop for repairs. A Prestige transportation manager, after receiving a notification of a hard brake, was able to see live video on his phone of the company's semi being driven around 7:20 p.m. Using real-time GPS coordinates, the manager relayed the location of the truck to officers, who found it parked in the 100 block of North 8th Street, unoccupied. A criminal complaint said that Clayton eventually admitted to stealing the truck. Officers found the key to the semi in his backpack. Before the arrest, officers said the defendant decided to try and run before being brought to the ground by arresting officers. The arresting officers also found a Smith & Wesson 357 Magnum with ammunition in his backpack. Officer Chris Whelan was injured in the arrest, sustaining some scrapes. In a subsequent interview, the complaint details that Clayton said he wanted to do something fun, telling police that he was going to, quote, get some drugs and commit suicide, unquote, after the theft. A preliminary hearing is scheduled for March 6th.
Gilmore City man pleads guilty of filing false tax returns and theft. A Gilmore City man pleaded guilty to six different counts of federal court after stealing over $156,000 through his tax return preparation business, according to the U.S. Attorney's Office. David Miller, age 52, pleaded guilty to three counts of aiding and assisting in the preparation of false and fraudulent income tax returns and three counts of receiving stolen government money or property. Miller will be required to pay all of the stolen money back to the IRS. In a plea agreement, Miller admitted to preparing fraudulent income tax returns through his tax preparation business between tax years 2012 and 2015, depriving clients of part of their tax refund as a result of theft. Miller stole money belonging to the U.S. government through 39 partial client tax refunds from 2014 to 2016. He also failed to report stolen funds as income, resulting in additional tax obligations for himself, totaling nearly $31,000 from the years 2011 through 2016. Miller faces a maximum combined sentence of 13 years in prison and a fine of up to $350,000 in the case, which is prosecuted by Assistant U.S. Attorney Ron Timmons. Sentencing in the U.S. District Court will be set after a pre-sentence report is prepared. Miller remains free on bond until then.
The community calendar, the Fort Dodge Civitan Club, 7 a.m. Zacharias, guests are welcome, and the Golden K Kiwanis, 9:30 a.m. at the Tompkins Celebration Center, Friendship Haven, and the speaker is Shane Campbell, plant manager, Coke Fertilizer. Fort Dodge Public Library Preschool Story Time, 10 to 10:30 a.m. Fort Dodge Public Library, 424 Central Avenue. The Blandin Memorial Art Museum is open from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m., 920 3rd Avenue South, and their admission is free. The Fort Dodge Senior High Class of 1953 will meet at 11:30 a.m. at the Sports Page, and the Fort Dodge Senior High Class of 1955 will meet at 11:30 a.m. at the Sports Page. Webster County Genealogical Society will meet at noon to 3 p.m. in the Fort Dodge Public Library, 424 7th Central Avenue, room 134. Noon Lions, noon, will meet in the Lions Den. A.A. Al-Anon Club will meet at noon and 7 p.m., 12 North 7th Street. The Fort Dodge Duplicate Bridge Club will meet at 1 p.m. in its open game at Citizens Central. Nickel Bingo, 1 p.m., Multipurpose Senior Center, Emmitsburg. Bets Off, GA, 5:30 to 6:30 p.m., Community and Family Resources, 726 South 17th Street, and the phone number is 576-7261. The Fort Dodge Writers Workshop, Section 2, 6 to 8 p.m. in the Fort Dodge Public Library, 424 Central Avenue. Open AA meeting is 7 p.m., St. Mark's Episcopal Church in the Fox Hall, 1001 South 1st Avenue. AA, 7 p.m., open meeting, 510 South Jackson in Eagle Grove. And if you want an event listed in the community calendar, send the information at least 2 weeks in advance to the Community Center Messenger, 713 Central Avenue, Fort Dodge, Iowa, 50501, or email it calendar@messengernews.net.
It is now 8:28, and we will begin the obituaries, the first one being Larry Moore of Des Moines, who passed away on February 23, 2020, at the Taylor House Hospice following a brief illness. Larry Moore was born in Fort Dodge in 1943. He spent his younger years in Gilmore City, where he graduated from high school. He continues his education at the University of South Dakota before transferring and graduating from the University of Iowa. An Army veteran, Larry served as a helicopter pilot during the early years of the Vietnam conflict. Following his military service, Larry joined the family business, Midwest Limestone, which he expanded beyond quarrying by starting calcium products, a business he grew into a world-leading manufacturer of granulated limestone and gypsum. While attending the University of Iowa, Larry met and married Susan Benson in 1964. They lived in Storm Lake and Humboldt before moving to Des Moines upon their retirement. Larry loved to play golf. One of his claims to fame was achieving two holes in one during the same round of nine holes. Wow. Uh-huh. He added another hole in one to his scorecard on another golf outing as well. Larry and Susan enjoyed many interesting trips, including their life together and including a walk across England and a transatlantic flight on the Concorde. Visitation will be held at Dunn's on Friday, February 28, 2020, from 5 to 7 p.m. A private burial will follow at the Union Cemetery in Humboldt. Larry had a big heart for animals and was a proud supporter of the Animal Rescue League. Memorials can be directed to the Animal Rescue League in his honor. His wife, Susan, will miss his gentle companionship and good humor.
Michael Mike Lewis Hansen out of Kanawha. The visitation will be held on Saturday, February 29, 2020, from 2 to 4 p.m. at the Ewing Funeral Home, 118 East 2nd Street in Kanawha, with a brief memorial service following at 4 p.m.
Eloise L. Clasey, and that is spelled C-L-A-E-S-S-Y. Eloise L. Clasey, age 100, of Marshalltown, formerly of Fort Dodge, died February 20th, 2020 at Graceview Heights Rehab and Healthcare in Marshalltown. A service honoring Eloise's life will be at 11 a.m. Saturday, February 29th at the Gunderson Funeral Chapel with the Reverend John Himbry officiating. Interment will be in the Laverne Township Cemetery. Visitation will be from 10 to 11 a.m. Saturday at the Gunderson Funeral Home and Cremation Service. She is survived by her sons, Richard Clasey of Marshalltown, Don and Barbara Clasey of Avondale, Arizona, 6 grandchildren, 10 great-grandchildren, and many nieces and nephews. She was preceded in death by her husband, her parents, and 2 brothers, Jay and Lauren. Eloise L. Olson, the daughter of Martin J. and Jenny Tesdall Olson, was born August 5, 1919, on a farm near Hardy. She attended schools in Hardy and graduated from Vernon Consolidated School in 1936. She married Eugene Clasey in 1938 and lived for a time near Renwick. They also lived in Fort Dodge, Monmouth, Illinois, and Chetek, Wisconsin, before her husband passed away in September 1976. At the time of his death, they were both employed at the Chetek Research Company. She returned to Fort Dodge and was a member of the Trinity United Methodist Church, where she was a member of the UMW, was a flower chair for a number of years, and a member of the Helping Hands Group and also the Prayer Line.
Hubert Vogt Bradgate. Visitation for Hubert D. Vogt, 76 of Bradgate, will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday at the Harris Funeral Home in Gilmore City. Private family services will follow Friday at 11 a.m. at the Marble Valley Cemetery in Gilmore City. A complete obituary can be read at www.harrisfuneralservices.com, and those are all small letters.
Judith A. Winkler, a massive Christian burial will be at 10 a.m. March 3rd at Corpus Christi Church in Fort Dodge. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to service, Corpus Christi Church at Fort Dodge. And that website is www.lauffersweilerfuneralhome.com.
Jacqueline R. Millia, Fort Dodge. Jacqueline R. Millia, 64, died February 25th, 2020. Per her wishes, there will be no services. Online condolences may be left at www.brucesfuneralhome.com.
There's a picture on this page of the clock tower of the Webster County Courthouse that was taken in August of 2019, and the clock tower restoration project is scheduled to begin soon. It will begin on March 9th, and the courthouse will remain open, but part of South 7th Street will be closed off. Construction on the high-priority restoration of Webster County Courthouse clock tower and roof will begin on March 9th. That's the day that contractor Newman Brothers Incorporated of Des Moines will start to build scaffolding and bring in trailers for fencing. Once construction gets underway, a portion of North 7th Street from Central Avenue to an alley behind the courthouse will be closed to accommodate construction equipment and materials. Construction for the bid awarded to Newman is $6.16 million, and it is expected to wrap up by the end of the year. There will be no disruption on Central Avenue or any of the surrounding streets. This is a tough project, said Chad Bunner, principal project manager, before articulating the plan of attack at Tuesday's pre-construction meeting at the county with the county stakeholders. We've got about 9 months to rock and roll. Scaffolding installation on the clock tower itself will not happen until later in phase two. The building will remain open for county business during the entirety of the construction, including two potential first-degree murder trials anticipated this year. The scaffolding will encompass the face of the building and bridge around the tower anchored to the building's stone joints. A 3D scan of the tower will help guide the project after scaffolding is installed, before and after the removal of the iconic green-tinted copper sheathing. All the copper and wood will be stripped off the tower and stored in two semi-trailers on North 7th Street. Since it's a big copper job, I'm concerned about theft, Bunner said. Supervisors are mulling with ideas to save unique pieces of copper for local museums and other fundraising ideas. Phase two will also replace the skylight, a process anticipated to take 6 to 8 weeks in the summer, during which the roof will be at least partially open. Only temporary rubber will separate business on the third floor from the elements. Flat areas of the roof will be renovated last. We're going to do our best to keep the water out during the construction process, the manager said. I guess we better pray that it doesn't rain much.
Oh, boy, with spring.
I know. Construction workers are expected to operate from 6 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. on most days. Newman was awarded the bid for the project in January, even though it came in over $1 million more than the previous consulting engineer estimates. The project was found to have a daunting effect on contractors. Greg German, a structural engineer for Shuck Brightson of Des Moines, said previously that many contractors had no frame of references on how to go about the project. Many found they did not have enough time to wrap their heads about how large this project would be or to articulate their plans in time to submit a bid. The restoration has been in the works for well over a year. A key part of the restoration will include installation of a plastic membrane to act as a water barrier between the copper and the wood of the tower, leaving most levels dry. The top level of the tower is open to the air so that the bell can ring. The water burial will be designed so that water can flow back outside, preventing rotting of the wooden structure underneath. Roof construction will replace the fiberglass with glass, significantly increasing the amount of light that comes in and removing the yellow tint from more than 100 years of UV exposure that currently comes from the roof. The new glass will have a longer lifespan with a better ability to resist impact from ice during the winter. The project's blueprints include a partial replacement of the clock tower that will keep intact the pieces of the old green patina sheathing and restore the roof's skylight. The change may result in a browner clock tower overall, a departure from the green color earned over a century. The sheathing's extensive weathering over 118 years contribute to the need for this action. Sounds like a huge, huge project.
There was a reminder on these funerals. Betty Lou Lindner, 10 a.m. Wednesday, Gunderson's. and Keith Davis, 11 o'clock a.m. Thursday at Gunderson's. The gathering is 10 to 11 a.m. on Thursday. And the in-service is Ellen Shepherd and Eloise Clacy. And then at Loffersweiler's, Judith A. Wingler, age 79, and the funeral is Tuesday at 10 o'clock a.m. at Corpus Christi Church. Visitation Tuesday from 9 to 10 a.m. at Corpus Christi Church. So we can go on to the next page.
You want me to go ahead?
Okay. Hazmat team responds to a warehouse fire in Scranton. And this is out of Scranton, and it's by Chad Thompson. When a large warehouse containing paints and other flammable liquids caught fire in Scranton Monday night, the Region 5 Hazardous Materials Response Team, headquartered in Fort Dodge, was called to the scene. The fire was reported at New Way Trucks, 101 State Street, located in Greene County. The warehouse is almost 49 miles from the Fort Dodge Fire Department. Multiple fire departments were dispatched at 11:23 p.m. Monday. No injuries were reported, according to Greene County Sheriff Jack Williams. At 12:23 a.m. Tuesday, the hazmat team was called. The fire chief knew there was larger quantities of flammable liquids, so he called for technical assistance and advice, Fort Dodge Fire Chief Steve Hergenrader said. Hergenrader said by the time the hazardous team arrived on the scene, the fire was under control. The local fire departments did an outstanding job of putting out the fire, Hergenrader said. The hazmat team consulted with the incident commander at the scene. They wanted us there in case things got worse, Hergenrader said, but they were able to prevent it from spreading. Williams reported significant damage to the paint area of the building where the fire started. The rest of the building just had some smoke damage, Williams said. The cause of the fire is not considered suspicious. They were painting some small parts with an electrostatic paint system, Williams said. It arced and caught the paint on fire. Williams added, he went to spray more paint and ignited the paint with the arc. Firefighters were on the scene for about 5 hours, Williams reported. Firefighters from Scranton, Jefferson, Grand Junction, Glidden, Ralston, and Carroll responded. And there is a black and white picture here of smoke damage is visible on the siding of the warehouse that caught fire Monday night at New Way's truck in Scranton. The Regional 5 Hazardous Material Response Team, headquartered in Fort Dodge, responded to provide technical assistance and advice.
We skipped over the opinion page to get to the obituaries on time, and the Messenger editorial today is the biodiesel tax credit is back, and Iowa producers can now look forward to robust growth. In 2017, Congress failed to extend a key assist to a new and growing industry. The biodiesel tax credit was allowed to expire. This $1 a gallon credit was designed to subsidize renewable biodiesel production so a young industry can grow into a point where it will no longer need government help. Letting the tax credit end will make it harder for existing biodiesel producers to evolve and prosper. It also discouraged others from launching biodiesel plants. Congress has not been consistent in its support for these promising industries. It has allowed the tax credit to expire 4 times since 2009. This is unfortunate because a robust biodiesel industry can help Americans achieve a long-term goal of having diverse sources of energy. Biodiesel producers also will have the potential to be important contributors to the Hawkeye State's economy. Consequently, all Iowans will benefit when biodiesel producers thrive. That's why U.S. Senators Charles Grassley and Joni Ernst have worked hard during the last 2 years to get the biodiesel tax credit reinstated. Fortunately, that was finally accomplished in December of 2019. Congress made the credit retroactive for all of 2018 and 2019. This is making it possible for producers to recover some of the loss in financial strength that was caused by the long period when the tax credit was not in place. To make that recovery occur more quickly, Grassley and Ernst have just written jointly to the Commissioner of the Internal Revenue Service, urging the quickest possible processing and payment of the retroactive tax credits. With our strong support, Congress took action and renewed the tax incentive for 5 years in order to support this important industry and provide a positive market signal, with two senators writing, "Timely payment of claims for 2018 and 2019 is necessary for the recovery of the entire biodiesel industry, including producers, blenders, and farmers." This newspaper, meaning the Messenger, strongly agrees and applauds the hard work by Grassley and Ernst in looking out for the biodiesel industry in our state. It is sad and, quite frankly, inexcusable that Congress let this tax credit expire and took so long getting it back online. Fortunately, our senators continued to press for action and were finally successful in their quest. Despite the setback, the delay in getting the tax credit back in place brought about Iowa's 11 biodiesel facilities currently having the ability to produce nearly 400 million gallons annually. As this industry expands, it will provide an increasingly important market for soybean growers, which is good news for agriculture in Iowa and for continued prosperity in our state.
We have one more editorial here, and it's by Matt Cosgrove. Matt Cosgrove is the director of the Webster County Conservation Board. Iowans have a reputation. The headline is, "Iowa should invest in natural resources, recreation, and water quality." Iowans have a reputation of being hard workers, honest, neighborly, connected to the land, and genuinely Iowa-nice. Unfortunately, this reputation does not hold true when we look at our state's record of protecting its natural resources and investing in outdoor recreation. It has been almost 10 years since Iowa amended the Iowa Constitution to create the Natural Resources and Outdoor Recreation Trust Fund. This was no small undertaking, passing two sessions of the legislature and an overwhelming vote of 63% of Iowa voters in 2010. Yet here we are, 15 years after the legislature established the Sustainable Funding Committee to identify solutions to address Iowa's water quality issues, soil loss, recreation and park funding challenges, and general, quote, quality of life and amenities, and not one dime has been deposited in the trust fund. Iowans have missed over $1 billion that should have been invested in enhancing water quality in natural areas in this state, including parks, trails, fish, wildlife habitat, and conserving agricultural soils. The 2006 Sustainable Funding Committee was made up of a diverse group of Iowa stakeholders, including commodity groups, conservation organizations, public health officials, sportsmen and women, legislators, and environmental supporters. The charge of the EC committee was simple: explore mechanisms to adequately fund Iowa natural resource and recreation needs. The committee explored a variety of options, but evidently settled on a 3/8 of 1 cent sales tax increase. This model has been used successfully in Minnesota and Missouri for over three decades. The new funding was estimated to provide approximately $150 million annually that would flow through existing programs and be accountable and measurable in an annual report. A funding formula was created in Chapter 461 of the Iowa Code and agreed upon to distribute the funds into seven categories: natural resources, soil conservation and water protection, watershed protection, REAP, resource enhancement and protection, local conservation partnerships, trails, and lake restoration. So, what is all the fuss about? Iowa ranks 47th in public lands with only 3% open to public use. 1 in 5 Iowa children are considered obese. Over 40% of our lakes and rivers are considered too polluted for fishing and swimming. Over the past two decades, Iowa has lost 1.6 million acres of habitat. 25% of Iowans are not physically active, costing the state an estimated $5.3 billion annually in medical costs and lost worker productivity. Iowa compromises 3.3% of the land area in the Missouri watershed, yet is responsible for 55% of the nitrogen pollution in the river. 89 of Iowa's 99 counties have seen their population decline over the past decade. Only about 50% of Iowa's university graduates with a bachelor's degree are able to find a job in Iowa after graduation. More than 90% of Iowa's wetlands have been drained, resulting in 951 flood-related disaster declarations at a cost of $13.5 billion. Iowa is losing topsoil at an average of 5 tons per acre annually. While the list can go on and on, it's not all gloom and doom for our great state. There are many positives to focus on as we look to 2020 and beyond. Iowa's voted to create the Natural Resources and Outdoor Recreation Trust Fund in 2010, developing the roadmap for Iowa's path to success. A child's risk of obesity can be reduced by 60% if he or she lives close to parks, trails, and green space. Each 30 million visits are made to Iowa's lakes and rivers, generating about $2 billion in spending. In 2018, Governor Reynolds and the legislature took the first steps to improve our state's water quality by passing SF-512 to dedicate funding towards implementing the nutrient reduction strategy. Towns like Madrid are reaping the economic benefits of the High Trestle Trail, with over 250,000 visitors spending $6.7 million in Boone and Dallas counties last year. Outdoor recreation in Iowa generated $3 billion in consumer spending. The Charles City White Park Water Park is boasting a $1 million economic impact in the town of 7,300 people. On January 14th, Governor Reynolds gave the condition of the state address and made a visionary statement, asking legislators and all Iowans to join me in taking the first bold step right now, this session. In the coming weeks, I'll be introducing the Invest in Iowa Act, a bill that will significantly cut income taxes, create a substantial fund source for our mental health system, reduce the burden on property taxpayers, and fund the Natural Resources and Outdoor Recreation Trust Fund. Governor Reynolds has kept her promise and is traveling to Iowa communities, spreading the message about her Invest in Iowa plan. There are good conversations occurring across the state regarding potential funding for Iowa's Natural Resource and Outdoor Recreation Trust Fund, mental health, and tax relief. I would encourage you to be part of the conversation. Contact your legislatures and encourage their support in making 2020 the year Iowa invests in our natural resources, recreation, water quality, soil conservation, rural revitalization, economic development, public health, mental health, workforce, and Iowa future. Now is the time to clean up our rivers and lakes, protect our soils, invest in recreation, build active, vibrant communities, create opportunities to improve the health of Iowans, expand our trail network, repair our park infrastructure, provide access to quality outdoor experiences for our children, and create an environment that will attract and retain a skilled workforce. The time is now to join the governor and take first bold to step to, quote, invest in Iowa, quote, in 2020. And included in the article are the way in which you can contact your local people, President Donald J. Trump in the White House, and they have his call, and Senator Charles Grassley, and Senator Joni Ernst, please contact, and Representative Steve King. And all of these people have their websites.
Okay, now it's time to read the long-term forecast. We're down to about 5 minutes here. Today's forecast, again, is to be cloudy. A high around 23 with a low around 13 and winds from the north-northwest from 11 to 16. On Thursday, mostly cloudy. High around 31 and a low around 16. On Friday, mostly cloudy. A high around 32 and a low around 16. On Saturday, sunny. High around 41, a low around 25. Further down the line on Sunday, partly sunny. High around 48 and a low around 30. Monday, mostly sunny. High around 44 and a low around 30. And Tuesday, partly sunny, with high around 47 and a low around 31. So it looks like some warmer temperatures are coming. And that's not too bad for almost getting into March here.
I think I'll read a little bit out of the sports because the Fort Dodge, the Dodger double, Fort Dodge boys, Anderson captured the state bowling championship. And it's a wonderful picture of the team for the bowling team. And it says 2020 Class 2A Bowling State Champions. And they're holding up the flag. And also included is Caleb Anderson of Fort Dodge. And he's posing with his individual state title in Waterloo on Tuesday. And this is out of Waterloo, and it's by Eric Pratt. And it's just a wonderful article on the championship of these people that have worked so hard on their team. The Fort Dodge boys bowling team potential was a topic of conversation all year long, even as the Dodgers struggled through the dual portion of the season and went winless in the CIML Iowa Conference. All of the questions were answered emphatically on Tuesday as the Dodgers won the Class 2A state championship at Cadillac Langs. And they are anchored by a gold medal performance by a junior, Caleb Anderson, his head coach, Nick Vincent's squad, and they prevailed by just 4 pins over runner-up Urbandale. Anderson's title was even closer as he finished a single pin ahead of Cedar Rapids Xavier senior Dave Weevil for the crown. "I am so proud of everyone on my team," said Anderson, a 3-time individual state qualifier. "And every single one of those guys tried their absolute best to give us the best opportunity to win. Myself and some of my teammates have been bowling together for over 6 years, and we used to talk about how we would win the state title together someday. It's just great to see everyone on the team step up and do this well after all of the close losses. It was always a tough ride home after those meets. We finally were able to figure out what we had to do to be a team."
There is an event coming up soon. It's called the Home and Garden Show. It's 3 days of interesting programs. It will be held at the Iowa Central East Campus on Friday, March 6th, Saturday, March 7th, and Sunday, March 8th. There will be speakers, and there will be workshops going on, and there will be many, many vendors there at this Home and Garden Show. Admission is free, but they would like you to bring maybe some cans for the local food pantry because they are having a can drive. That, again, is the Home and Garden Show, which is sponsored by The Messenger, and it is held again at Iowa Central's East Campus. That brings us to the end of this session of Reading the Messenger. All the materials heard on IRIS are intended solely for the use of the blind and print handicapped. If you have any questions or comments about our program, please give us a call at 515-243-6833 or visit us on the web at iowaradioreading.org. We thank the folks at Friendship Haven for giving IRIS a home in Fort Dodge for so many years, and we thank you for listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the blind and print handicapped, wishing you all a dream to bless and a star to guide.